This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you for coming to remember and honor Philippe Lacoulabat. I just received an email from Jean-Luc Nancy, who says he's very near, he's with us. There are some texts by him that are displayed that you may want to read during the reception. And I want to welcome you all here from very different places, and so many people unexpectedly, perhaps, though one would have expected them from Berkeley. I want to welcome you very warmly. You've worked with Philippe, and you've remained in touch with him according to your modalities. Now, this is the first reflex. It's not even a reflection yet. It's just a reflex in response to the departure of our friend and teacher and beloved thinker, Philippe Lacoulabat. We are going to organize a symposium to think together about his work next spring. Right now, we're just in the first steps of trying to assimilate the disaster of his leaving us. And if anyone understood distress and wrote to us about distress, it certainly was Philippe. If I had time in this introductory moment, I would have spoken perhaps about the rhetoric of ethicity, which is unparalleled with the burden of or inflated assertions of prescriptive discursivity. The calm and clarity and lucidity with which Lacoulabat took certain kinds of risks with an unprecedented reserve. I'm sure others will think about this for us and with us. Today we think about not only his poetry, and some of his poems will be translated later on. We'll hear one of his poems in particular in Spanish, in which he teaches us about the signification of tears, which means for Philippe in this poem that first of all, tears mean that we're prey to time, something that we want to consider. We open today's Andenken with also the poem Andenken, which is beautifully translated by Richard Seaberth, who has given much thought to this address of Andenken and Denken an, thinking toward and with and trying to address our great friend. Also, we might consider his work on Dichtmut, the courage of the poet, and what Hölderlin might have meant or worked through, so to speak, in terms of courage and poeticity. Philippe Lacoulabat often stood alone, even though he was the most outreaching of thinkers, partnered up momentously with Jean-Luc Nancy, with Bailly, and a number of others. His politics extended to institutions as it retreated from their deluded complacencies. He never gave up on poetry. He was among the only rigorous philosophers, apart from Schopenhauer and sometimes Nietzsche, to have heard music and let it in. He had perfect pitch for historical disaster and the caesura. He cleared terrible abysses and scanned the losses that pockmark something like a rhetorical unconscious. He stood up together with Nancy to read Lacan for Lacan. Lacan characteristically blasted his own disciples for not being able to match the acuity of the title of the letter, where they exemplarily took on the master psychoanalyst. His care and carefulness remain unparalleled. We have lost a friend. A world has gone down, But what's left, was bleibt aber, is a certain rhythm to which he holds us, a still pulsing beat by which we hold him. Hölderlin, the Greeks, Nietzsche, Heidegger, all acquired the dignity of a contemporary beat, an unheard of interlocution initiated and sustained by Philippe. Thank you, everyone, for being here to help to sign in and sign for Philippe's arrival tonight.
À vous, dont d'un poème. Le nordais souffle, le plus cher qui d'entre les vents ne soit, car il promet la flamme de l'esprit et bon voyage aux mariniers. Mais va maintenant, et salue la belle Garonne et les jardins de Bourdeaux, là-bas, à la pique de la rive, où s'avance l'embarcadère et tombe le ruisseau tout au fond du fleuve. Mais, au-dessus, regarde au loin un noble couple de chênes et de trembles d'argent. Il m'en souvient très bien encore. Et comme ces larges cimes, le bois d'orme les incline au-dessus du moulin. Mais dans la cour, c'est un figuier qui pousse. Là même, au jour de fête, vont les femmes brunes sur un sol soyeux, au temps de mars, lorsque la nuit s'égale au jour et que dessus les lents embarcadères, lourdes de rêves d'or, s'étirent de berçantes brises. Mais qu'on me tende, pleine de l'obscure lumière, la coupe parfumée qui me donnerait le repos, car serait doux parmi les ombres le sommeil. Il n'est pas bon que prive d'âme de mortelles pensées. Bon, en revanche, est de s'entretenir et de se dire ce qu'on pense en son cœur, d'entendre longuement parler des jours d'amour et des hauts faits qui s'accomplissent. Mais où sont-ils, les amis? Bellarmine, avec son compagnon. Beaucoup n'ont pas le cœur d'aller jusqu'à la source. La richesse, en effet, commence dans la mer. Eux, comme les peintres, font moisson des beautés de la terre et ne dédaignent pas la guerre ailée, ni d'habiter, solitaire, à longueur d'année, sous le mât sans feuillage, où ne trouent pas la nuit de leurs éclats les jours de fête dans la ville, ni le chant des cordes ou les danses du pays. Mais c'est chez les Indiens qu'ils sont partis, les hommes, maintenant, là-bas, par la pointe venteuse, au pied des vignes, là où descend la Dordogne, et ensemble, avec la splendide Garonne, ample comme la mer, il part le fleuve. Et la mer retire et donne la mémoire. Et l'amour aussi attache avec soin les yeux. Mais ce qui reste, les poètes l'instituent.
I'll try to say in English a few words to introduce the text, and I ask you to excuse my accent. during his last stay in the hospital, Philip asked me to bring him a small notebook to write in. One of these many nights which I sat by him, waiting for him to die at dawn, because the doctors kept announcing his death as imminent, I opened this notebook and found this short text. When he woke up in the morning, because Philip always woke up and said, "Salut," I confessed to him that I had read it during the night. I wasn't allowed to read what he had written unless he asked me to. And I asked him whether he would allow me to read it at his burial, which we had been talking about several times. His answer was, "Wait, I have to rework it." Philip did not believe there was any urgency. He knew he was going to disappear. In a way, he had always disappeared. But he wanted to live his disappearance, to survive his disappearance. His last project was to rework a text from his youth, written in 1966, at a period when Philip dreamed of being a writer, not a philosopher, which bore the title "The Disappearance" already. He prepared the title page, a dedication to Gérard Genette, a double epigraph from Blanchot, and this small text entitled "Postface to the Disappearance," with the subtitle "These Notes Are Posthumous." He had twice passed through a coma. He kept reading in his last days Lazarus by Malraux. He remarked with malice that he had been resuscitated twice, each on a Sunday. Better than that other guy, he said. He died on a Saturday evening at midnight as a poet. Now I read it in French. Deux fois, donc, je suis mort. En l'espace d'à peine quelques mois. 25 mai 2006, 29 décembre de la même année. Chaque fois, usant de puissants moyens, on m'a ramené à la conscience. C'est l'expression consacrée. C'est-à-dire à ce monde en son entier qui est, parce qu'il paraît, sans la moindre exception. Mais chaque fois, j'eus la furtive intuition que ce qui s'offrait comme le monde était avant tout qu'il existait, qu'il était présent, d'une existence qui précédait imperceptiblement la pleine existence de tout. Tel fut l'envers de la disparition, un effacement de la condition de l'exister, cette pure impossibilité. En somme, furtivement, l'impossible me fut possible, un éclair puis la nuit. Et à ce signe, je reconnus soudain la condition de l'existence poétique, laquelle n'est pas de traverser les apparences, il n'y a pas précisément d'apparence, mais de se risquer à se tenir au lieu, point d'origine du paraître, qui est tout. funambulisme métaphysique sans garde-fou métaphysique. Ou si l'on préfère, expérience métaphysique évidée, pure exposition au néant, dans son absolu retirement même.
How is it possible to speak after this? I rely, as I have done before, upon the infinite generosity of Claire Nossy and share with you my insignificant memories. I last saw Philippe at the burial of Jacques Derrida. I remember being shocked at how old he looked. I remember thinking instantly, I too am marked by age, since Philippe and I saw each other often. That is the terrible thing about last meetings. Most often you don't know they're last. You don't make them the monuments that they are. Philippe and I were of an age. In 1991, Derrida had remarked to me that I should be 60 seems odd, but acceptable. But that Philippe and Jean-Luc should hit 50 seems unacceptable somehow. Since Jacques' death, I have thought of that remark many, many times, and I memorialize it in a different way with you here today. Philippe belonged to a time in my life that has now turned golden in memory, the 70s and the 80s, under Derrida's benign and magisterial shadow. In those early celebrations of Derrida, there was a certain sense of conspiracy I shared with Philippe. He and Jean-Luc knew him when, and I was fortunate enough to have caught him just before he became so tremendous a celebrity. This sense of conspiracy developed into a sort of shared intellectual passion at the first Derrida Décade at Cerisy-la-Salle, I believe in 1980. That's where Avital and I met. It is the events of that time that come to mind now. I think of Philippe's gentle humor, indeed a certain gentle but sharp, indeed a certain diffidence, combined with that absolutely acute, honing-in kind of imagination. From time to time, I was even a little bit in awe. There, too, I had no sense of an ending, but in fact, I was about to take the gift of deconstruction elsewhere. With unspoken agreement on both sides, after that first Cerisy, I no longer came to the in-house Derrida events. Looking back, that summertime in Cerisy with Philippe has yet another kind of monumentality. I saw him soon after at Yale, when I was a fellow at Wesleyan in 81, perhaps 82. It was Diman who had asked me down, and we spent an evening at Maury's with Diman eating dinner. By then, the sense of an intellectual sharing was evident, it showed. Many people in this room know that I stammer when I speak French, never having received institutional instruction. I am merely a reader of French. Diman, having been my advisor at Cornell, knew this better than most. Yet all through that evening, and I almost feel like turning to Philippe and saying, "Remember how strange that was." All through that evening, Diman turned to me again and again to interpret for Philippe. I have treasured this curious detail, even spoken of it to friends. Today it comes to me that it may well have been almost the last time I spent time face to face with Diman as well. Last things again. In between, there was a hasty conversation in the 90s with Philippe in some public place in Strasbourg or Paris about Heidegger and the Nazis, and Derrida's place in that. An inconclusive conversation, no place to end. Finally, the last glimpse, a quick embrace. I am getting on myself now. I'm not from a long-lived place. My friends are dying. I have moved around so much in my life, in space and thought, that I'm becoming adept at counting times of meeting, a peculiar kind of witnessing for someone on whom there is no moss. Old friend, I wish we'd lived in the same city. You do want me to read a little? I hope you'll forgive me if I read three scholarly paragraphs from the book the two friends produced when I was in their orbit, L'Absolu Littéraire. I'll read from the English translation, first a learned bit I have always loved on the moral fragment, and then the absolutely brilliant ending of one of the chapters in La Critique. In fact, this is the ending in the English book that speaks to us today as it did in 1978. This is the moral fragment. Closer to home, and yet without breaking the thread of the Latin tradition. I like this passage because of where it ends. I've always loved the way the moral fragment ends. And yet without breaking the thread of the Latin tradition, the moral genre of the fragment points toward the genre of the moralists themselves, toward that genre of hortatory discourse that Rome had, in fact, illustrated, but that henceforth develops in terms of subjective utterance. That is, in the specifically modern mode of the statement, parole, of authority, through which social and literary authority relay the authority of thought itself. The difference in utterance that makes all the difference, for example, between Gracian's Oraculo Manual and Epictetus's Manual, or between La Rochefoucauld and Marcus Aurelius, is indeed also constitutive of those ideas in which, as Ayrault notes, Schlegel introduces the I of subjective utterance into the fragment for the first time. But if this modification of sententious utterance and this transfer of authority indeed signify that the truth is henceforth constructed and no longer simply gathered and transmitted, one consequence at least becomes clear. The subject of sententious utterance itself must now, the authority of these young writers is just exquisite. The subject of sententious utterance itself must now coincide with the function of exemplarity traditionally fulfilled by the aphorism or maxim. On condition, of course, that someone is listening, which is never dependent on the strength of its voice, nor even, as in ancient rhetoric, on its power of persuasion, but rather on its skill, address, if you will excuse the bad wits, and you remember they have written on wits by now, the bad wits in addressing itself, that is, in orienting or directing utterance itself. Hence its recourse to what we have called the style of injunction, for the conditions have now been assembled that will allow the coincidence of the aphorism's subject with the exemplary value of what it utters. The conditions have been assembled, in other words, that will allow for the establishment of a relation of imitation between the uttering subject and the interlocutor. If one takes into account, however, the inflection that ancient imitation has undergone in modernity, if consequently one grants the concept of imitation the very sense that the Romantics will convey upon that of artistic creation, and they're in full flow after this. I've always really liked this passage because it brings us into our own time in this extremely authoritative and scholarly way. And now just that last bit. The true critic. They're writing about the true critic. Romanticism seeks to perfect aesthetics according to the sole aesthetic motif to which it cares to respond. The literary genre is the idiomatics of the idea. What an extraordinary sentence. This is something to contemplate. The literary genre is the idiomatics of the idea. But in this manner, it brings into play the effects of the slow, imperceptible, and constant torsion that the motif of criticism, as we have constantly seen, and the motif of character have imprinted. This is indeed the correct word, and we know what that parenthesis means, imprinted on idealism. It is that time. The idiomatic Aufhebung, which is undoubtedly Aufhebung itself, sublates meaning within meaning and language within the idea, a conjoint sublation of philosophy and of poetry, because it no longer restricts itself to the unique theme of pure vision or of theory. Rather, it demands their putting into form and discreetly directs this theory, completed as literature backdoored itself. In making the highest task of characteristics, that of constructing a concept according to its becoming, furnishing the concept's inner history along with the concept itself, romantic criticism opens onto that simple yet tortuous history in which Hegel's dialectical Darstellung proves closer than it seems to Nietzsche's artistic genealogy. Thank you for letting me speak.
It is with a great emotion that I will speak tonight. And this emotion was, of course, reawakened when I saw once more Anne Denken, and I had a little, this unheimlich feeling, hearing Philippe Lacoulavert's voice coming from darkness while the camera was panning on Bordeaux, and I realized that I was in that city at that time. So I was in that film. And I'll try to explain a little what it means. But I'll begin with a more recent anecdote. A week ago, I had to meet my daughter's teacher in the French International School of Philadelphia. Knowing that I would have to wait, I had taken with me La Poésie comme expérience in French, and I was reading. When my turn came after the evaluation, she pointed to the book and she said, "My teacher," surprised. And it turned out that this teacher, quite young, had studied philosophy in Strasbourg before coming to teach French in the suburbs of Philadelphia. I asked her to say a little more. She said, "He was always very clear, not like his colleagues who got us entangled in Kant." She had something against Kant. And she added, "I still remember every word he said." The curious coincidence was that I could say almost the same thing, even if my memories date back to an earlier period, precisely 1965, the moment when that film was shot. It was then in Classe de Terminale Philosophy at the Lycée Michel Montaigne of Bordeaux, the high school of the center of the city, in which Philippe's father was the headmaster and my father was a teacher in Cagnes. When we, as students, would refer to Monsieur Lacoulavert, it was, of course, Philippe's father, with a lot of respect. He was, after all, the boss. Philippe was Lacou, simply for short. We were, in a sense, united by being two sons of the institution, but at different levels. He was 9 years older than I am, and he never had to undergo the torture of sitting through classes taught by his father, whereas I had to do that. We were in philosophy, which meant a special group, special skills. We were supposed to know German, Latin, Greek, and were discovering philosophy, but Philippe didn't teach philosophy to us, but French literature. But I can say that from the start, he bowled us over. His classes were, of course, in a sort of smoke. Everybody was smoking in those classes. And I remember almost everything. It was not a conventional literature class. We read Nietzsche on tragedy, Racine as a reader of Aristotle's Poetics, Montaigne's Apologie de Raymond Sebonde in the context of skepticism, Hegel on the novel, Proust Recherche as a rewrite of the Phenomenology of Spirit, Du Boucher, Char, Feuillet d'Hypnose. Amazing when I think of it now. He gave us papers to write that were very difficult. And I remember one in which he had asked whether La Chartreuse de Parme exemplifies Hegel's definition of the novel, the conflict between the poetry of the heart and the prose of social contacts. I had tried in a mischievous manner to demonstrate that this was not true, that Stendhal's masterpiece could not be reduced to the meditations of a German philosopher. Philippe Lacoudabart wrote, I remember, 3 to 5 dense pages to prove that I was wrong. He had written more than I had, and that a novel was capable of being interpreted by Hegel, and I had to admit that he had beat me there. It was a time indeed I remember we were all, as we would say, we would realize later, des petits monsieur, we all had a tie, and we were all pretending a lot, but he would beat us systematically. For instance, I pretended to him that I had read all of Borges' stories, and he caught me there. But there was one day when he really surprised us. We were doing something on the invention of humanism, and he asked us, Pomponazzi? What? Pomponazzi? You don't know Pomponazzi? And Pico della Mirandola? He looked around. Nobody said a word. De Omniscibili? You don't know De Omniscibili, Pico della Mirandola? Our dismay came from the fact that it was a real surprise, that he really expected us, age 15, 16, to know about Pico della Mirandola. And it's a surprise. I experienced exactly the same surprise a few years later having taken a class by Paul Celan to a group of Normaliens taking German. Paul Celan had this passion for strange vocabularies, dictionaries, and so on. And we were doing all the meanings of the word Pferd, horse, in German. And at one point he said, what? You don't know how to say Pferd in 18th century Picard dialect? And he looked at us, and of course nobody knew. What I would like to call up at that time is this atmosphere of Bordeaux, full of tidings of pre-68, and I know how important 68 was for Philippe. The Comité Vietnam were sustaining anti-American agitation, as one can see in Godard's film. Godard himself had come to Bordeaux to present his favorite films. We would gather in a bookstore called Mimesis, Librairie Mimesis, which there was the friendship with Pontevia, and whose wife was in charge of the Librairie Mimesis. And we would often meet at Pessel's, who was also our philosophy teacher, a good friend at that time of Philippe Lacoudabart, and spend nights drinking wine, smoking a lot of cigarettes, discussing philosophy, psychoanalysis, literature, film. That's during one of these evenings that I heard him talk about Hölderlin's trip to Bordeaux, his stay in the Allée de Tourny that you've seen. I don't know whether you recognized it. The painting was the Allée de Tourny with the Meyer family. His visit to Blankfort, and I indeed heard that he had shot some images of that film. The idea, if I remember well, maybe was to film something called Hölderlin in Bordeaux. What you saw was a good fragment of it, but it was to have been a little longer. This was a time, 1965, when the Beatles were more popular than Jesus, when de Gaulle was renewing his alliance with Russia, and like Hölderlin, Philippe was soon to move north, moving to Strasbourg, a city of which we heard a lot at that time, because it was the place where the influence of the situationists or the pre-situationists was most acutely felt. And this was a time when we'd exchange the first issues of ES, including that issue somebody stole from me with a mirror on the cover. Bordeaux was, of course, not Greece, as Hölderlin believed. It was, of course, a little industrialized, even more then than now. But as you see with the from the Bec d'Ambez, but was very close to the kind of meditation on the Rhine River that Heidegger was producing more or less at that time. And so I would leave this to another history, other historians. I have kept in touch, and this friendship was renewed when Claire and Philippe would visit the Philadelphia. And what has remained, I think, throughout all those years as identical was the handwriting that you see on the film, and which would cover our papers. And I want to thank Philippe Lacour-Dabart for this gift, which I think Hölderlin sums up very well. Was bleibt aber, stiften die Dichter. What remains has been founded by the poets. We saw Philippe not as a philosopher, not as a literary person, not as a teacher or friend, but as a poet. He gave me a great gift, the greatest gift perhaps, because he made me think about literature. And what's more, he made literature think for me. I will never thank him enough for that, but this is already contained in Andenken, Andenken.
Philippe Lacour-Dabart, he was my teacher, and I'm honored and moved to remember him here with you today, inscribed and excribed by his teaching and his work as I am. It was in the last century of the last millennium, in my very first semester of graduate school at UC Berkeley, that I first found myself in the space of his teaching, his text, his word. It was a seminar on Bataille, co-taught with Jean-Luc Nancy. This seminar, its intensity breathtaking, inspiring in its suffocating brilliance and relentless rigor without epistemological guarantee, this seminar overtook me, and I was thrown into the texts of Bataille, Hegel, Heidegger, Derrida, Lacour-Dabart, and Nancy. The Bataille seminar saturated that semester and has tinted and textured my every subsequent textual encounter, that is, life. And in some crucial way, that seminar has never ended. Jean-Luc went first. Custodian of the initial half of the seminar, he led us impossibly into, out of, through, under, near, far, with, without Bataille's expérience antérieure. Those Tuesday afternoons, as I tried to hear and listen and write down every word, there in Dwinell Hall, in a modest room with a wall of windows overlooking the plaza, a room flooded by the pixelated Northern Californian autumn sunlight, I wondered if anyone could truly gauge what kind of critical shakeup was taking place, how what was happening in that seminar room rocked the institutional principle that produced the monumental architecture and logic of the university itself. And when LL arrived, the earth moved. You'll see what I mean. By the time he'd arrived mid-semester, I had read L'Absolu Littéraire et Le Titre de la Lettre and was, as are so many, fascinated by this writing couple, Lacour-Dabart and Nancy. I was eager to see Lacour-Dabart for the first time. What do I remember of first seeing him? Entering the room, taking his place at the nondescript table, I remember the composure of one whose apparent quietness was stretched over a high-frequency vigilance of being. I remember a briefcase. He removed a stack of smallish, light-yellow papers covered from margin to margin with that tiny, impeccable handwriting. I was in the front of the room near the center. I remember his crossed feet and olive leather shoes that laced up the side, not in the middle. He straightened the papers and began. I was struck by what seemed to be such a different rhythm, key, or mode of being than Jean-Luc Nancy's, but at the same time sense their intertwined parts in what Avital calls finitude score. And she was there too, Avital, in that seminar in Bataille. That's where Avital and I met. And on that day, L.L. began his exquisite lectures on Bataille's souveraineté. His quiet, relentless intensity grew, retreated, ebbed, flowed, music and text patiently, agonizingly, uncompromisingly moving toward, repelled by, the unthinkable thought of souveraineté. And then it came before we knew it. The earth moved. An earthquake. The earthquake of 89. Have you been in an earthquake? You hear something. It. Feel something. It. Are you hearing it or feeling it? It comes as a rumbling felt in your body, too quick for consciousness to apprehend until it's over. And then you wonder. You're frozen, wondering. It comes and doesn't arrive until it's gone. What? What? What was that? What happened? But I can see his face now. As I saw it exactly then, in the après-coup of the quake, in the après-coup or before it, or that is, during it, in the moment that you felt but somehow missed, in his face, the quake that I did and didn't experience. This earthquaking movement, that shifting and rending the flow of time, throwing you off, was it the uncanny echo of the césure, that interruption or break that characterizes history in and as its manifest impossibility? The rest of the seminar that semester unfolded without geological correspondence to the work being offered in the classroom, but the earthquake, the trembling, it never ceased. The following year, we were gifted with another seminar on Hölderlin, Adorno, Heidegger, and Benjamin, on Das Gedichtete, or Ce qui est poématisé, on what Lacoulabert writes to us in another context as la poésie comme expérience, which is to say the non-lived experience of that which doesn't arrive, doesn't take place, but is the experience of a dangerous traversal nonetheless. Never failing to be attuned to this experience, Lacoulabert, as Jean-Luc Nancy wrote in his recent homage and adieu, Lacoulabert scrutait l'approche de l'autre scène. This was the risk and responsibility of his thought, his text, his teaching. True teacher, he gave us to thinking, which is to say he gave us over to it, submitted us to thinking without recoil and without recourse to mimetic comfort zones. But even after visiting these abysses, there was the wonderful, warm, wise, witty man, the teacher, L.L., with whom we'd cherche un petit verre after seminar. We'd go upstairs to the mezzanine of a dark jazz barbecue joint on Telegraph Avenue. I see him now. I see my classmates. I see him talking, smoking, drinking, laughing, listening, watching, welcoming, and teaching, still teaching, always teaching. So I offer my gratitude to you, L.L., evermore gratitude for your courageous, shattered and shattering texts and thought and teaching. Your thought insists and insists without settling. Ever more necessary, your unflinching readings of aesthetics and politics, especially today and today and today. I don't know if we can bear l'approche de l'autre scène as you did, but in and with your memory, we will continue to give ourselves over to the demands of reading and thinking. Philippe Lacoulabert, an earthquake still.
I wanted to evoke an afternoon in 2005 when I went with the poet and photographer Suzanne Dalpelt to hear Philippe Lacoulabert give a lecture for children at the Théâtre de Montreuil. The lecture was originally entitled Pourquoi fait-on de la musique? Why does one make music? Later published as Le Chant des Muses. Lacoulabert spoke about our desire to make and listen to music, referring to the muses and to their relation to language and memory. I wanted to share the memory of this lecture with you, of having infiltrated amongst the children to listen to Lacoulabert speak about the infancy of thought, about music and memory, about music as memory, and how, even if unavailable, this memory structures us, as does the musicality of language. The talk was part of a series called Petite Conférence. The idea was to invite philosophers, historians, and scientists to give lectures designed specifically for children one Saturday a month, and was inspired by the programs for children composed by Walter Benjamin for the German radio between 1929 and 1932. La Coulabarte began on this Saturday by introducing philosophy and philosophical thinking, telling the children they shouldn't be afraid of the big word philosophy. One learns it little by little. Petit à petit, he reassured the little ones. Why does one make music is a philosophical question, he told them, because it is a question of origin, and philosophy is interested in questions such as why is there such a thing? Par où ceci ou cela existe-t-il? Philosophy, which means the love of knowledge, consists in being astonished with what there is, and even that there is what there is. Invented by the ancient Greeks in the Greek language, philosophy speaks Greek. The word music also comes from Greek, and here the leading actors appeared on the stage, for e musike means the art of the muses. These muses were goddesses from Greek mythology, the daughters of Zeus and Mnemosyne, whose name comes from mneme, memory. Mnemosyne was in fact the goddess of memory, and like their mother, the muses were also the guardians and goddesses of memory, as well as of music and poetry, and therefore of language. Music, as the muses imply, is intimately related to language. La Coulabarte then made a small detour through science to explain to the children that our relation to music, or musicality, goes further even than the earliest childhood experience, back to the womb. The fetus might not hear external sounds, but it can hear the mother's voice, and the musicality of the mother's speech is our earliest experience. It is a memory so early and deep it is forgotten, but it is continually sought after in our desire to listen to music. And here I'm going to quote from the Petite Conférence. It all happens as if before being born and finding oneself in the world, out in the open, in the midst of things and of beings that one learns how to see, to touch, to taste, among which one learns how to move, how to love or to fear, even before we experience pleasure or pain, even before one fills one's lungs with air for the first time and lets out one's first cry, one has already had in an extremely deep memory, so deep it is forgotten, one has already heard an aspect of language, its music. Thus, if music seeks to imitate something, like all art, according to the Greeks, it would be this thing heard absolutely prior. Music would seek to find this thing once again to make an echo of it. End of quote. The music heard in the womb is muffled, however, by the maternal body. In fact, in order for sound to travel, it needs amplification. Music would be the amplification and clarification of what we experience in the womb. The task of music, said La Coulabarte, is to clarify the maternal stifling of sound. Despite the fact that La Coulabarte had reassured the children, telling them not to be afraid of the impressive word philosophy, Suzanne and I looked at each other at one point and whispered, "It's too difficult for them." We were sure it was going over their heads. But the lecture ended, and the question and answer session began, and to our surprise, the children started asking questions. They had understood everything. How many instruments are there in the world, they wanted to know. How many gods did the Greeks have? What are the names of the muses? Their questions revealed a fascination with numbers to La Coulabarte's amusement. Les chiffres avec vous, c'est incroyable, he exclaimed. The numbers with you, it's incredible. There are also more elaborate questions. One child wanted to know if the pervasiveness of music in restaurants, elevators, waiting rooms, wasn't a way of distancing ourselves from our internal music. And would that still be music? Another child entered into a dialogue with the philosopher. If he followed La Coulabarte's reasoning, did this mean that a people without language would not have music? La Coulabarte asked the child in turn if he knew of any people who had no language. If such a people existed, it would not have music. The child seemed incredulous. Does that seem totally obvious to you? He insisted. One perceptive child wanted to know how the Greeks, who didn't have the technology to examine what we experience in the womb, could have such an acute understanding of the connection between music and memory. Lacourt-Labarthe's response as his lecture, in a way, was to mention the detour taken by the Greeks through mythology, through the muses, and through stories such as that of Ulysses and the Sirens, whose song was more potent even than the maternal voice. Another child asked if one could classify the sensory organs in such a way that the ear would be the noblest sense organ, and might a parallel be drawn with animals? Lacourt-Labarthe disagreed with the imposition of any such hierarchy, but he admitted that there is, in fact, a hierarchy of the senses in the history of philosophy. The Greeks gave priority to sight. For Nietzsche, the sense of hearing was more noble and revealing, for it gave access to one's interiority. What especially interested Lacourt-Labarthe, though, he admitted, was the openness of the ear, the way the sense organ never closes. Kant complained a lot about this, he told the children, for music disturbed his work. Indeed, Lacourt-Labarthe's interest in music has gone beyond music as a merely acoustic phenomenon. If the muses were the guardians of memory, he would say, they were also the guardians of thought. Lacourt-Labarthe was fascinated with music as something that arouses and awakens thinking itself. Our desire to hear music as an urge to re-experience something from this deep memory of before one's birth linked all of us in the theater on that afternoon, adults and kids alike. And, as Lacourt-Labarthe said, we also shared the susceptibility to being moved by music. And I quote again from the Petite Conférence. In the mother's womb, the child cannot be told apart from its mother's body. There is no space, no distance. If it hears something, that makes it immediately react, stir, enact a movement, be moved in the strict sense of the term. What I mean to say is that if music exists, it is to rediscover this very first emotion. In the context of the series of Petite Conférence, this lecture can be seen as replete with symbolism. If the amplification of sound is a way of rediscovering a musicality clarified of the muffling effects of the womb and the indistinctness from the mother's body, here in this auditorium, the children were being talked to as separate, independent beings, being taken seriously, responding with interest, independence, and comfortable enough in the friendship offered to pose questions, challenge, and be moved.
Well, I would like first to tell you how moving it is to hear, to see you and to hear you. And first, I want to thank Avital for having invited me to be here tonight. I want to thank her also for having provided me with a deflector that would allow me not to address too directly the absence of Philippe. I am here answering a message she sent me on March 1st. It is true that one does not refer to emails as calls, a word that it seems to me is medium-specific, reserved for telephone communication. In any case, I was invited to join tonight's memorial event by a message whose subject read, "Returned mail." Not being a good typist myself, I am all too familiar with that type of message. Familiar, but not really used to it, since there is something intrinsically unheimlich in these messages that refuse to be delivered, that you end up sending to yourself. However, in the case of this precise message, there was something even more strange, an additional turn in the uncanny. For the usual return mail message I receive are always messages I originated myself, while here it was returned to me, even though I hadn't sent it. This strange return was a first. I don't know if everybody who is speaking tonight received the same invitation. I don't know either if it was intended, but it was a kind of signature message. If I let myself indulge in this slightly out-of-place digressive introduction, it is, as I said, because it provides me with what I would call a screen experience in the sense of Freud, screen memories, a fetishistic aside that allows me to avoid the difficult task of facing Philippe's absence. but it is also because this message, in all its uncanniness, brought back a series of recollections of his presence. Like a few other French friends, among whom I should mention Sarah Kaufman, as well as Jean-François Lyotard, and no matter how often I'd met them in France, either before or after, my relationship with Philippe is one of the French friends with whom my relationship was based in or centered around Berkeley, where I was teaching at the time, when he used to visit during the fall quarter. You might maybe wonder what link there is between Berkeley, Philippe Lacoulabarthe, and my return mail message. It is, should I say, of course, bien entendu, to use one of Philippe's recurring phrases, it is, of course, Avital, who was there too, working on her telephone book and providing us with countless jokes, anecdotes, gossip, all turning around phone calls and other long-distance telecommunication devices, of which Philippe, feeling slightly unfermed, was a very active user. The most spectacular of those stories was, of course, the collect call Derrida had received from a certain Martin or Martini Heidegger. Philippe was very much a continental philosopher somehow, and I am not sure that he was always ready to cheer up at what he considered to be the mysteries of American academic style. And I remember his ironic smile and the way he often invoked an English, which in fact was not as poor as he claimed, in order to be excused from the scene. I reopened some of Philippe's texts, in particular Typographies, which is the first text by him I remember having read. It is not a book, but his contribution to the collective memory volume, Mimesis. So was it named after that bookstore? Yeah. Mimesis, Desarticulation. Looking at my copy, I was struck by how heavily it is underlined. Like the layers of a geological map, my successive readings are marked in a variety of colors, black pencils, green pencil, red inks, red pencil. Some passages are underlined more than once. I hadn't remembered that I read it so often. What and why do we underline the books we are reading? Among many other reasons, we, or at least I, do that, I think, out of the feeling that one way or another we'll have to return to the text we are reading. That something there calls us that we are not yet ready to answer. The feeling that the time went by too fast, which is a note that on the other side of the text comes back very often under Philippe's pen. He very often expresses the feeling that he does not have enough time to achieve what he intends to do. I will quote a series of French sentences. Évidemment, je ne pourrais pas le faire dans le temps dont je dispose. Of course, I wouldn't be able to do it in the time allotted to me. The same feeling transpires in the frequent sentences where he uses the conditional to refer to what, for whatever reason, he is not going to do. Il faudrait, on pourrait le montrer très précisément, on pourrait invoquer un bon nombre d'autres textes. Even in a kind of unintended mise en abîme, just after having shown that Heidegger's commentary of the 10th book of Plato's Republic is based on the fact that Heidegger excluded the beginning of Plato's book from his reading, Philippe opens the following parenthesis: one cannot read everything, I have to summarize, to go straight to the essential, even though one should, bien qu'il faudrait, follow each detail. Il faudrait. Time is too short to say it all. The shortness of time is not the only thing at stake here. I've already mentioned the frequency of his bien entendu. Is on n'ignore pas. Faut-il le répéter? Il va de soi. Je le dis brutalement. Hein? La coulabasse reader often feels pushed in the position of the addressee of the last two pieces of L'Imitation des Modernes, that is Derrida and Lyotard. To Derrida, he says, tu vois très bien où je veux en venir. To Lyotard, he says, tu sais aussi bien que moi. Hein? There are also the texts that start abruptly with a donc, like the one Claire read tonight. I was struck by the donc that appears as a second word, giving the reader the feeling of being a late intruder, of arriving in the middle of an argument whose premises he missed, and probably missed because they go way back in the long durée to an ageless past. The same haunting agelessness is at work in La Coulabart's reflection on imitation, which since typology is one of the most active motifs of his work. Rereading it, it was easy for me to remember why its pages were so heavily underlined. It is as much of La Coulabart's work a subtle and powerful subversion of the concept of mirror stage, or more accurately, of the concept of both the mirror and the stage. It is, so to speak, an archaeology of the way from Plato to Heidegger and Lacan. Mirrors have always been used by philosophers in order to frame and stabilize, in order to identify, to endow identity with a subject and subjects with an identity, rather than to generate uncanniness. How the mirror is the instrument of the triumphant Perseus, the civilizing hero, the master of Medusa. It is the tool of a domesticated mimesis, a mechane, a device meant to contain the threat of the fascination of mimesis within the visual field. Refusing thus to imagine an image, a representation, that wouldn't obey a model, that wouldn't be the copy, the reflection of an original. La Coulabart's subversion of this restricted model of mirror, or of the mirror as a model, liberates the ghost of a non-speculary, primal, savage mimesis. It allows him also to delineate what he will later call, in a very Girardian mode, L'Imitation des Modernes. That is, the double bind of a modernity caught between a claim to originality and its flip side, the loss of faith in any original.
In Susan, I had my first mentor. In Philippe, I found a second, a teacher who taught me solely through his writings. Books I learned from La Coulabart can be mentors too. And I mean this without exaggeration, because there is something unique about La Coulabart's writing, about his style, about his form of address, that departs from the otherwise Faustian conditions of academic research. The fate of an academic often seems to be a paraphrase of a famous line from Joseph Conrad, "We read as we dream, alone," but not when one reads La Coulabart. His work possesses a dialogic quality that ruptures the Faustian image of abandonment among the dead letters of the library. La Coulabart does so by always keeping in mind the reader, the audience, the student, one who is often equally alone in libraries and living rooms. As a writer, de Coulebat is for me the paradigm of a Vordenker. A Vordenker because he's a Mitdenker, a model for not only how one should approach text, but how one should present that approach. He not only thinks with his authors, whether it be Hölderlin, Schlegel, Wagner, Heidegger, but also thinks with, before, and alongside his readers. De Coulebat, in other words, writes as I imagine he taught, didactic without dominating. He never shies from displaying not only where the path of his thought leads him, but how he gets there, including the detours and apparent dead ends. His writing is the simulcast, the emerging image of his thought, constantly reflecting on the questions he poses, constantly pausing to highlight, rethink, and reformulate, and most importantly, constantly engaging both the author under investigation and the reader. In picking up a book of de Coulebat, one sits down at a seminar table. On almost every page of his work, one finds sentences that pause, reconsider, and clarify. Sentences, in other words, that put the process, the path of thought, on center stage. Here are just some very few examples chosen quite literally at random from typography. These assertions would seem to create a paradox. I am therefore bound to explain them a bit. But let me add right away that this is not the essential part of what I have to say. Indeed, I am much more interested in carrying out the counterproof of this hypothesis. Yet, in saying this, I would like to forestall at once a possible misunderstanding. But here's the question I am posing, the question I'm asking, rather, is the following. This all-too-small collection of citations, of fragments, chosen at random and presented in isolation, may say little, and certainly not enough, to begin to capture the gesture, the ductus, of de Coulebat's written presentation. But I hope it slightly circumscribes what fascinates me about de Coulebat. Not only his unparalleled philosophic production, that goes without saying, but also the manner of presentation, the generous, open, and honest form that nevertheless refuses to compromise subtlety and meticulousness. A subtlety and exactness that arrives through the art of the question, of the well-posed and reposed question that opens up avenues of thought and invites one to join in, listen, and engage. De Coulebat's fearlessness in revealing the path of thought, his honest engagement with both text and reader, his openness to the other, all this for me is de Coulebat, the teacher I never met. He is one who frees us from the Faustian isolation of intellectual work.
I'm offering something like a little postage stamp on everybody else's addresses. It's very short and something like a hasty portrait, which is inevitably wrong, but it's on my way to thinking. I just take a long time to think, and I'm not ready yet. We met quite late in 2003 in Chicago, but it was as though in the continuum of shared friendships and thought, we had long been participants in overlapping affective and intellectual geographies. I was a more recent arrival. Philippe's presence punctuated conversations, not so much in what he did say as much as what he didn't, in what he held in reserve, in a look, in a gesture. Claire often provided the rhythm and the tune, Philippe its punctuation. In wanting to associate some image with Philippe, I think of Malraux's cat, the figure of the vanishing presence, hesitant at the threshold, inhabiting the elegance of the almost disappearing trace. I attended the seminar he gave at Northwestern on Heidegger's text Die Armut, on poverty, which has been translated into French, it has been published in French, but not translated yet, and a year later on Marx and the Lutheran conditioning of Marxist thought. Of course, Heidegger and Hölderlin were chief people even in Marx and Luther. I've witnessed the other side of Philippe's withdrawal, his absolute lack of withdrawal in thought, his true life, so to speak, a force of sobriety in thought and meticulous attention to the slightest detail. In some ways, it was as though all of Philippe's energy, went into a kind of negative dialectical negation of itself, not for the sake of sublation, surtout pas de métaphysique, but to be sublated, to give all clarity, not to himself, to his person, but to the negation of the person in the work, hence, to use a phrase from Jean-François Lyotard, la gloire d'un chat, the glory of a cat.
Just the right size for me. I met Philippe Lacoulabart in Freiburg in 1986 at my own house. I had landed in the guest rooms of a Freiburg Germanist named Gerhard Baumann, and in that late summer, in the first days of a Fulbright year, at the invitation of Friedrich Kittler, I opened my rooms to all those who would be my mentors that year, including especially Friedrich Kittler and Gerhard Neumann. Friedrich arrived at my soiree with two distinguished guests in tow. I bade them welcome. They were Jean-Luc Nancy and Philippe Lacoulabart. And I now remember Philippe very vividly for his look of gentleness and intense curiosity, reserve, and keen interest. I knew his name, and I was honored. He was well known in 1986 as author of the wonderful innovative intervention From Across the Rhine in the very German topic of German Romanticism, a book completed a decade before, as witty and as dazzling in its own right, as Gayatri has shown, as were Schlegel, Novalis, and indeed Hölderlin at their brightest and most compact. I've recalled, or do I now only recall, that moodful ingathering of the two youngish sparks, Jean-Luc and Philippe. Sparks, some centuries ago, meant men about town of wit and elegance. And these two were certainly in 1986 and long afterwards the two sparks in the new town of philosophy, the Alemannian megapolis of Strasbourg and Freiburg. There were to be answering sparks that late summer evening. The party was interrupted by a summer storm. Thunder broke, lightning flashed, Wetterleuchten, summer lightning, like the Blitze adored by Novalis, for whom wit was eine geistige Elektrizität, an intellectual electricity, but for which, as we now sadly recall, feste Körper, solid bodies, are necessary. The rain rained into our Riesling, and Philippe left before I could get to know him better. My friendship with Philippe exists donc in my distress at its evanescence. I did not wonder too hard about how it was that Philippe came to my party. It was enough to consider that he was visiting other spark wits and ripe heads in Freiburg, foremost Friedrich Kittler and Gerhard Neumann, whom I had invited. But only now I realize that it was in 1986 that Philippe published his exquisite, accurate essay on Celan's poem Totenauburg, in Poésie comme Expérience, and Philippe would have been interested in visiting or revisiting the house of Gerhard Baumann, my host, who accompanied Paul Celan to the chalet in the Totenauburg in the car driven by Gerhard Neumann. The scholarly work of wit to which I referred above was, of course, L'Absolu Littéraire, published in Paris in 1978, and afterwards widely read as The Romantic Absolute, published in Albany, 1988. This is a work, even at this moment, intensely studied, as at Princeton, in the dissertations of Brian Tucker, quote, reading riddles from Romanticism to Freud, Joshua Gold, quote, in Stürmen der Zeit, Poetics and Revolution in the Works of Friedrich Hölderlin, and Mai Mergenthaler, quote, ein unendlicher Dialog, das Projekt der Frühromantik in den Athenäumsfragmenten, Fractions on the Periphery, that I want to mention tonight. To suggest with what measure of appreciation Philippe cited, I shall read from the dissertation of Brian Tucker. Wit, having become a marginal form of knowledge during the Enlightenment, was then rescued by the Romantics, who raised this marginal and effortless form to an ideal. Lacoulabart drawing on the etymology of witz as a doublet of wissen, classifies wit as, quote, the name and concept of knowledge that is other of knowledge. See the presence of that other term to which Mr. Goebel was referring. This other of knowledge that is other than the knowledge of analytic and predicative discursivity, end quote, of Philippe. For the romantics, wit remains the possibility of opening a space of knowledge, thus Brian Tucker, beyond that of rational judgment, and it furthermore offers a different means of acquiring knowledge, not one of laborious process, but rather one of instantaneous achievement. Joshua Gold's dissertation abstract reads, Walter Benjamin, T.V. Adorno, Paul de Man, and Philippe Lacoulabart have noted how this, quote, disavowal of impulsiveness is an abiding concern in Hölderlin's writings, but Voice of the People also illustrates his aim, Hölderlin's, of engaging his countrymen in dialogue on this matter. Watch the term dialogue. Mai Mergenthaler thinks of her dissertation, which also centers on romantic dialogue, as, perhaps mistakenly, a counter-intervention to l'absolu littéraire. In such, I'm glad that we have adduced the topic of the dialogicity of Philippe Lacoulabart in two modes. In one instance, a speaker stressed the hiddenness of the dialogue out of which the text emerged. In another instance, the speaker spoke of the immediate presence of the dialogue, and that has given rise to these dialectical interventions to literature absolue on the issue of the dialogicity of the romantics in the representation of Philippe Lacoulabart. But this, as I say, these are the ways in which Philippe is now being remembered, even his earliest work, and will no doubt continue to be remembered by us who are his students. But dissertation writers, some more than others, require sub-mediation as well. Susan has been that midwife. So it might not be futile for me to mention that on review, the mentors of my own year in 1986, whom I cited above as Friedrich Kittler and Gerhard Neumann, must now include Philippe Lacoulabart. I did not meet him again and know his image now chiefly and intensely from the film Der Istar, showed last June in Strasbourg, at a meeting of the International Association of Philosophy and Literature called Between Three, Arts, Media, Politics, and in this sense, centrally honoring Philippe. And yet how clearly and directly did Philippe's interests become mine? If I now list them, it is just to do honor to the didactic force of his writing, which continues to work impersonally, even invisibly, in the manner of a force field. Two long essays that I wrote in 1986 were called first Wit and Judgment on Lessing and Kant, which must have been informed without my entirely realizing so by Philippe's work. And second, Disowning Contingencies in Hölderlin's Empedocles, which was explicitly informed by Philippe's marvelous elucubrations, which I did study on how the drama Empedocles might have constituted a suicidal refutation of Hegelian idealism, a dramatic plot or argument, articulating a philosophical argument or thesis. My Empedocles essay appeared to my great delight next to Philippe's stunning piece titled Poetry's Courage in Aris Fioretto's volume of essays called The Solid Letter, Readings of Friedrich Hölderlin. And Aris, who would like to speak to us this evening, offers us words which one can't do better than quote, it is his account of Philippe's work. And since these are refractions from A Periphery, I'd like to read some of these sentences. In this essay, Philippe Lacoulabart treats one of the implications of measure and calculation with particular attentiveness, namely destination. Beginning with an evaluation of Heidegger's Hölderlin interpretations from the 1930s and 40s, in which determination and destination are considered along theological political lines, and the courage of the poet is identified as that of someone who assumes a national vocation, Lacula Bat turns to Benjamin's celebrated analysis of Dichtermut, about which Avital has also written with great panache. In this poem, later entitled Stupidity, Blödigkeit, the motif of the poet's vocation is dealt with in association with a theory of das Gedichtete, or that which is poetically written. In contrast to Heidegger, Benjamin theorizes the topoi of mission and vocation as a courage to turn to das Gedichtete rather than to what might be covered by terms such as Volk or Nation, thereby conceiving of Hölderlin as the poet of poetry rather than as the poet of Germany. An entire politics is determined by this difference, Lacula Bat argues, who concludes by treating its implications for the contemporary discussion of the political stakes of theory. See how another writer has been inspired by a mere essay of Philippe's. Now, finally, I'll just add, in conclusion, in writing some years later myself on Nietzsche's moods, I found my thinking richly complicated by Philippe's own thoughts in his Typography, Mimesis, Philosophy, Politics, by his intuition of the fundamental link between musical moods and what he termed the autobiographical gesture. Nietzsche's rejection of Wagner, I was instructed to realize, involved his entire rejection of what can be called the discourse of moods, Stimmungen. With this half-autobiographical gesture, I mean to suggest the range of work done and now being done on work accomplished by Philippe Lacula Bat. And I invite all present to consider how deeply your work has been moved by his, perhaps impersonally, perhaps invisibly. A student of Werner Hamacher in Frankfurt told me this morning, as I was leaving for this convocation, that Jean-Luc Nancy had spoken to Werner saying, quote, "Now I do not have anyone to talk to." Many in this room and beyond it feel that way.
I'd like to start by just expressing my gratitude to Avital for bringing us here, and to Claire for coming for the event, and most of all, of course, to Philippe. In his novel Heinrich von Ofterding, Novalis has the character Heinrich say to Matilda, "I wish I could say to you everything all at once." There are a thousand different ways I could have started this speech, so finally I decided to follow E.T.A. Hoffmann's advice, what he wrote in The Sandman. I decided not to start at all. So since this is a sort of unknown genre to me, I didn't really write out a complete text, and as I heard the many beautiful and elaborate comments this evening, I started to ask myself how I could possibly have permitted myself such a thing. But I realized it had to do with the fact that this genre isn't known to me. I don't know how to mourn Philippe Lacula Bat, and I don't know how to express that. So, like Hoffman said, I decided not to begin at all. In 1983, Lacula Bat and Michel Foucault were both visiting professors at UC Berkeley. It was Philippe's first semester visiting there and Foucault's last. They never met. Somehow I ended up in both of those seminars, and you can imagine how important it made me feel as a young graduate student to be the secret informant between Lacula Bat and Foucault about what they were doing in each other's seminars. At the time, I was myself very off track, lost in a kind of mire of fairly draconian course requirements in the Complet program at Berkeley, according to which neither of those seminars counted. And I had forgotten, mostly what I had forgotten was philosophy. And Philippe appeared just in time to remind me, about thinking, to remind me about caring. So it was something of a thunderbolt, a Hölderlinian moment. And the strangest part was in the undergraduate seminar, which was a course on Baudelaire, which was populated by me, an undergraduate, and a sometimes visitor from Santa Cruz and her tape recorder. So I mention this particularly because no one really knew this seminar was going on. And it really became the was the place where I discovered what would become my dissertation, my first book that allowed me to continue in the institution. So I'm very grateful for what I learned in that seminar. And I was very moved to hear that Philippe had quoted Baudelaire in this late text that Claire shared with us this evening. In thinking over the many themes and terms and topics that are important to all of us in Lacoulabat's writing, I was reminded of a Schlegel fragment that says, in true prose, everything is underlined. So in a way, it would all be underlined, and everyone has mentioned pretty much all of it. This quote right before me was actually one of the few things I did write down that I was going to speak about. So it was very beautiful to hear that. I think I just wanted to say a few things about what in Lacoulabat's teaching moved me most. I was intensely swept up in the vertigos of subjectivity that he describes in much of his writing, what he calls l'écho du sujet, and the deep adventure of reading his essay, Typographie. I told him once, when I tried to teach that essay, I said, you know, that essay is really hard. And he said, oui, c'est ce qu'on me dit. That's what people tell me. Mostly, I still think of Philippe as a very important translator. People have commented on this already, bringing German literature and philosophy across the border into Strasbourg. It's itself kind of a place neither exactly French nor German. And I had the pleasure of visiting him and Claire there once, and we went and visited the Goethe Monument in Sesenheim, like the Sesenheimer Lieder. I think it's called a grange. It's a barn. So it's one of the few photos I have of Philippe. So as we all know, Philippe was an important translator from Greek, from German, of Benjamin. And I'll just recall this line from Benjamin's essay on translation. Translation does not find itself in the center of the language forest, but on the outside facing the wooded ridge. It calls into it without entering, aiming at that single spot where the echo is able to give in its own language the reverberation of the work in the alien one. This is, to me, very much describes the effect of working with Philippe Lacoulabat, knowing him, reading his books, listening to his seminars. I suppose technically the most important thing for me was Lacoulabat's presentation of Heidegger. And I'll echo what Eckhart Goebel was saying, that for me, it made it possible to read Heidegger. I had come from a much more German background and had been trained in German literature and philosophy, partly in Germany. And I was just utterly unable to read Heidegger until I encountered it through Lacoulabat. So I have him to thank for breaking up the German of Heidegger into translation and making it possible for me to read it, for providing a philosophical framework for dealing with what is probably not my own, only my deep ambivalence about the German tradition, and opening up for us so openly and directly the questions of Nazism and Heidegger's guilt and complicity, along with, at the same time, appreciating and continuing Heidegger's work in the destruction of metaphysics, the thinking of finitude, being, of thinking itself, and language. This is something I had never experienced before, and which made it possible for me to, and I know for many others too, to read Heidegger. So, of course, I want to appreciate and thank Philippe for his carefulness, attention, his generosity, his humor, his seriousness, his sobriety, his drunkenness, and most of all, I think I remember him as a thinker of the caesura. This has, of course, already come up quite a lot. This has always been a really compelling thought for me, the sense of the enrhythming of the self, its dislocation and spasm. In one place he calls it its tears, its laughter and tears, its non-identity, or rather our non-identity. And I'll just end with a quote from Philippe. Mais c'est peut-être un rythme simplement où je cherche désespérément à me reconnaître. Thanks.
I too thank Avital for organizing this very moving event. Regrettably, I never had the occasion to meet Philippe Lacoulabart, but I have an indelible image of him as a speaker scored on my memory from the film The Ister, where, as others have noted, in addition to the brilliance of his mind at work, we watch the fascinating way in which his intellectual souffle is synchronized with each pull on the cigarette. Looking back, however, cursorily at Lacoulabart's writings, many of them co-authored with Jean-Luc Nancy and initiated in three-way conversation with Jacques Derrida, I am struck by the groupings and pairings so characteristic of the 1970s. Deleuze, Guattari, Cixous Clément, Lacoulabart, Nancy, the latter quite literally a kind of sujet other or sujet groupe because of the heart transplant, which he named in an extraordinary essay, The Intruder. Lacoulabart and Nancy's writing came to fruition in an era of vivre ensemble. To write à deux was a kind of folie à deux, for it involved a risky leap into the persecutory arena of the I-thou, or the group we, even as it afforded release from the confines of monocentric thinking. Lacoulabart and Nancy's collaborative writing practice extended to the content of what they wrote. The emphasis on conjuncture and hyphenated fragmentation came through in their theory of romanticism and in their preferred lexicon, la jointure, le tien ensemble, the system subject. It becomes necessary, they wrote in L'Absolu Littéraire, to, quote, propose that fragmentation constitutes the properly romantic vision of the system, if by system one understands the not the so-called systematic ordering of an ensemble, but that by which and as which an ensemble holds together, tient ensemble with a hyphen, and establishes itself for itself in the autonomy of the self-jointure. The trait, the hyphen, the trait d'union, took conceptual form in their play on the word retrait as trace, trait, characteristic, copula, retreatment, retreat, withdrawal, defeat, retirement. These myriad significations played out in works such as Le Retrait de l'Artiste en deux personnes, or in an ephemeral text like Monogramme X, an epistolary exchange published after the failed Maastricht Treaty in France, and in an English language collection titled Retreating the Political. This last book played on retreat as double agency, quote, the recognition of the closure of the political and the political deprivation philosophy as regards itself and its own authority, end of quote. To retreat in this way is to critique political supplements, the transitory political movements that stand in for revolutionary politics, Gramscian, Althusserian, Maoism, or the beyond politics positions of a Heidegger or Bataille, each of whom, they believe, in different ways, set the terms of a non-dialectical opposition to mastery. To retreat the political is to go back to thinking about the grounds of originary sociality or the primal relation of subjects. It was to this end that Lacoulabart, Nancy, and Derrida, among others, helped found a Center for Philosophical Research at the Rue d'Ulm in 1980, conceived as a place of refuge and engagement. The center, they wrote, was withdrawn in relation to the sanctioned spaces of dialogue between politics and philosophy. This withdrawal must be understood then as an action, as a serious act of political theoretical commitment. In their desire to render philosophy an active irritant to other disciplines, Lacoulabart and Nancy avoided the palliative move towards interdisciplinarity in the contemporary sense of that term. Philosophy was brought to bear on other bodies of knowledge not as the disciplinary hegemon, but as a form of questioning that would make each discipline, including philosophy, ask questions of itself that might otherwise be foreclosed. In the 1973 book Le Titre de la Lettre, translated as the title of the letter, a reading of Lacan in the SUNY series, Lacoulabart and Nancy insisted on a philosophical intervention into psychoanalysis. Focusing on Lacan's agency of the letter, they put pressure on the algorithm as a driving calculus of thought. They maintain that Lacan, in his enthusiasm for tracking the signifier's drift, in his schematas of the subject, had disavowed the underlying force field of symbolic logic. Philippe Lacoulabart's name must now be added to the drumroll of losses to continental theory that, starting in the 80s, has included Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, Jacques Lacan, Roland Barthes, Louis Althusser, Michel Foucault, Michel de Certeau, Guy Debord, Paul de Mans, Kaufman, Sarah Kaufman, Félix Guattari, Gilles Deleuze, Emmanuel Levinas, Jean-François Lyotard, Pierre Bourdieu, and Jacques Derrida. I do not want to become part of a group of pallbearers, morbidly archivizing and historicizing the recent theory past, but it does feel right to use memorials such as this one to affirm the presence of a community of people who remain committed to reading and teaching continental philosophy, and who look forward to thinking the larger sphere of the political in and through the work of Philippe Lacoulabart. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for coming to Language, for being here. I made a spontaneous strategic decision not to go over some of the work that I wanted to do with you on Lacoulabart's thought on the non-subject, or the without authority, the without superego, that links psychoanalysis to politics. Instead, I will simply tell you some things about our encounters. I will thank Claire for making the trip to hold us and help us. Thank all of you for remembering so many moments through which we are circuited and by which we're traversed and by which we're linked. Those of you who haven't spoken yet, maybe you will want to, Richard and others. And maybe there'll be other sites and situations in which we can speak to one another through and with Philippe. Philippe commanded so much respect and invited awe by me, in a sense. I wonder if I was under anyone else's sway in quite that way, actually. And if you add to that something that might not have been mentioned yet, but some of you will recognize, I'm certain, those of you who know him, is the fact of his radical fragility, his reticence, his helplessness in certain ways, which always made me turn to psychoanalysis and its strangely emphatic relation to Hilflosigkeit as a starting point for a lot of thinking, helplessness. There was something about his helplessness and his forthrightness that astonished me always, because there was a strong tonality of ethicity, and some of the rhetorical moments were already evoked here today. I'll just tell you very quickly, because Shireen also already told you about the earthquake we shared, and the rumor in Berkeley was that the earthquake occurred because for the first and last time, Jean-Luc Nancy and Philippe Lacoulabart were in the same room. And the earth shook, and we all fainted and didn't know what was happening and asked them to separate. As a matter of fact, Jean-Luc told me that he had received a letter from Blanchot saying, "It's quite amazing that you two haven't destroyed each other." And he continued his breakfast, and I said, "I don't know what you think of this." I said, "How do you know you haven't?" That was the end of the breakfast. In any case, I'll just tell you, we also called him LL Cool, as you can imagine. And that there are three, I'm going to reduce this to three nano reminiscences. One is because I'm a troublemaker, and as a hysteric, I like to, those of you who know me and don't know me know, I like to make trouble and see what happens and destroy things. It's a great and maybe only jouissance. And so one day I said to Philippe with faux innocence, which is how I deliver my destructions, I said, so Philippe, I was just reading Paul de Man, and I was really surprised because in his section on Nietzsche, he says that you read Nietzsche as if you really don't know anything and as if it's your first reading of Nietzsche. This is the way I thank someone who's shown me only generosity, grace, the good breast, the good feed at each occasion. And this is how my gratitude pose articulates itself. And Philippe, with his intense look, and you see him go inward, and I thought, now I'm going to get him, because he was so calm, rigorously poised and sovereign, those of you who have worked with him and have known him, right? So I thought, now I'm going to piss him off, and he's going to start ranting or flipping out or something. And he said, oui, c'est vrai. And that was the end of it. For a hysteric, this is true failure. So I failed miserably to piss him off, upset him, turn him on maybe. Something failed. So that was the end of that. Another episode is he drove me home after an endless dinner, and he had to prepare his seminar, which he was very scrupulous about it. And I could tell that he barely wanted to stop the car. He almost opened the door and kicked me out. But I was in a really, one of my many, many or major nervous breakdown modes, and I said, Philippe, and he goes, yeah. And I thought, that's an invitation for me to open up. I said, my heart is breaking. I'm having a disastrous love affair. He turns off the motor, and he says, so, yeah, tell me about it. And for hours in the dark, in the car, he listens, and he delivered a devastating critique. I don't know what I wanted. I don't know what my demand was. I wanted to be cured, or I wanted him to understand what an asshole had done to me and so on. And instead, he delivered a devastating critique, and he said, and I'm sure I have the sense that this is part of something that you two must have worked out, because I heard you said something similar to Dutmann at some point. So I don't know. It was mimetically tainted, perhaps, but maybe I was the original addressee of a devastating critique, and very quickly and like a real teacher, he said, you have to learn the difference between love and desire. Then he opened the door and I could leave. This was the comfort zone I had found. I still want to talk to him about that. And the final, there's so much. The last time I saw him a few months ago, Claire hurt her back, and I heard him say when she was rushed to the hospital, I was alone with him, and he asked me to turn off his oxygen tent. And I said, no way. So he got very mad at me and kind of accused me of being hysterical. I said, well, what if I turn it the wrong way and it'll explode? He said, what? You can turn it to zero. Even you can. Okay, I'll turn it off. And then I turned off the oxygen tent, and he said, I don't want any shit from you. Get me my cigarettes. And so I didn't know. I wanted to call you. You were in the hospital already, but so I got him his cigarettes. I wasn't going to mess with him at that moment. So he smoked. And then he said, looking at me, referring to your fall, he said, it's a catastrophe. And that the way Philippe, we all have experienced, I think, his pronunciation of that word and what his, the way his eyes get deep with the word catastrophe. And I said, no, Claire just broke her back or something. That's not a catastrophe. And then he just looked at me, and I don't know what he was thinking, but I had the sense he recognized me for who I am. Anyway, the final moment that I wanted to tell you about was when I needed emergency style a blurb from him for Crack Wars, a book on drugs, and I thought it needed the dignity and seriousness of a blurb from La Coulabarte. So I ran into him in Berkeley and near the plaza, and I said, can you give me a blurb? He says, a what? I said, in my then French, est-ce que tu peux me blurber, s'il te plaît? He goes, what do you want me to do to you? You know. Anyway, I said, you know, on the back of these things, I could do it because we'll have to translate it anyway. And he goes, what would you do? You know that I'm a genius and you can't believe what... He said, I would be happy to give you that statement. And I was very happy and ready to run off. And he said, but you have to let me read your book, your galley proof. I said, it's in English. He said, okay, you come and you translate it for me. And I'm like, holy shit, he's going to like say it sucks or it's horrible, because I was very afraid of his judgment. And he did fuck me up once, because once I, well, admittedly with the sujet suppositaire, okay, I told him about it before I finished it, and he was grossed out, and that was tragically delayed by several months. I couldn't get back to it. I was paralyzed. So I thought, well, these are galley proofs. Maybe he won't stop this book from happening. But I sat next to him, and I thought, well, after one page, it'll be over. Hours later, when I'm like, Madame Bovary dit que... And I said, ça va? Ça va? Tu comprends? And he goes, non, mais qu'est-ce qu'elle dit alors? I don't know. And I'm there with a dictionary, and he insists before giving me the fucking blurb. I just needed one sentence that I'm a genius. But he didn't, not only didn't he judge me, which really surprised me, but he started laughing and he'd say, tu dis ça? He thought I was messing with his mind. He said, you're not publishing that. What does it really say? So there was a moment where I was on the verge of tears, and I started going conservative and pretending it was another text. He said, no, now I know you're lying. And so he said, he kept on saying, you're not publishing that, are you? And I said, look, without your blurb, it's not going to go very far. But yes, I am publishing it. Are you going to co-sign or not? He said, well, what's this part, this last 20 pages? And then I'll think of a blurb. And I said, yeah, but I need it like in the morning. I said, well, you're not going to get it in the morning. I have to think about it. So those are some of the things that happened with Philippe. I am so touched that we're all here and that we have joint and shared custody of him, and that we can perhaps hold our depletion in some way and continue to talk through him to us. Remembering the Hölderlin line, Seit ein Gespräch, wir sind. So from the moment of the interlocution, we are.